This is Financial Standard, the definitive source of news, thought leadership and analysis for Australian wealth management professionals. Financial Standard, take the lead.
Welcome to the Financial Standard podcast. I am your host, Karen Vergara, senior journalist at Financial Standard. Once the domain of sophisticated investors, private markets are increasingly turning heads among financial advisors and their retail clients. Today, we are discussing why they are feeling energized about this asset class with Stuart Haig, who is a director and head of investments at Spire Capital, an investment manager specializing in alternatives. Stuart, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Karen.
Stuart, what demand are you seeing for private market opportunities among retail investors and particularly among advisors and their clients?
Thanks, Karen. I think it's a good question. And in furthering your introduction, it's only been recently that retail investors have really been able to access global private markets. To date, the markets have really been the domain of the large institutions and ultra wealthy. And those able to access the global private markets have been rewarded handsomely by way of improved risk-adjusted returns relative to portfolios that are 100% liquid. The 30-odd years of outperformance has really provided a proof point or real evidence that a 30% plus allocation to global private markets is a real benefit to portfolios. And locally, we see evidence of this via the top 10 performing Australian super funds having in excess of 30% in global private markets. Now, that's all well and good if you can access those sorts of opportunities. And fortunately, of late, we're seeing retail investors able to access more and more private market opportunities. And that's being born out of two key factors. The first one is regulatory change in the Northern Hemisphere, both across the UK and the US, where the bar has been lowered for retail investors in accessing private markets. And the second key factor is product innovation by the private equity industry itself, where private equity managers have recognized that wealth management clients have got very different needs relative to institutions, namely liquidity and the ability to continue to allocate to the same vehicle over time. And that's because as advisors would well know, they're dealing with a range of idiosyncratic families that have got different needs through time, and they have clients that they're onboarding on a regular basis. So being able to access a single pool of capital on an ongoing basis, namely an open-ended fund, has been really key in making the products relevant for the retail part of the market. So the upshot of that is that advisors in serving retail clients have now really been given the opportunity to level the playing field with the likes of the industry super funds, which, like it or not, have been outperforming retail portfolios in the majority of the league tables. This access has brought about a new wave of demand from wealth management as the sector sort of structurally catches up with institutional market. Now, it's unlikely that advisor portfolios in Australia will ever sort of, steady state out at 30% like institutions. However, a simple increase of, say, 10%, so if base case allocations in private markets for private clients is 5% and that moves out to 15%, then that will bring with it around a $100 billion increase in demand on the basis that this part of the market is about $1 trillion. So $100 billion of additional demand, it brings with it a continued product innovation, because that's obviously quite an attractive pool of assets for potential private equity managers looking at Australia. So you've got this positive feedback loop where you've got a large expanding opportunity set and more deals and opportunities finding their way into Australia.
And Stuart, let's specify what the subsets are of the private markets asset class. What are they?
In defining what subsets are most popular in private markets, it's firstly worth taking a step back and defining the component parts. So in very simple terms, in private markets, you have unlisted or private companies, and you have unlisted and private real assets. So on the company side, it could be private debt or private equity, depending on where you're participating in the capital structure. On the real asset side, depending on the characteristics of the asset, it could be an infrastructure or a real estate asset. Infrastructure, as you can appreciate, is typically providing an essential service with monopolistic type pricing power. Real assets or real estate have their own sort of four or five food groups that many on the line would know, namely office, retail, industrial, multifamily, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
I think as we think about what that means in Australia, looking across Australian portfolios, you'll typically see some exposure to direct property. Mm-hmm. Advisors have been reasonably early, and I guess there'd be advisors listening to this that may have had some challenges with unlisted property trusts many years ago. But by and large, direct property trusts have been a valuable part of portfolios for advisors in Australia. I think the second cab off the rank and a less prominent the inclusion of direct infrastructure programs. And more recently, with the rapid increase in interest rates, both in the US and Australia, you've seen direct lending or private debt really start to grow in portfolio size in Australian portfolios. I think private equity is probably the one that's probably running fourth in terms of the adoption of the asset class locally in retail portfolios. There's been a couple of product providers come to Australian shores and have won some market share, but I think that's a real area of growth given that the amount of deal flow that's now starting to find its way into Australia as well.
So for those interested in investing in private market opportunities, what are some things they should be aware of? And Spire Capital recently published a white paper, Surfing the Wave, Avoiding the Reef, exactly about this.
Yeah, well I guess we've been fortunate to have been working in the private markets, me myself personally, for 15 years and my colleagues across the firm, similar periods of time. So we've been fortunate to learn a lot about private markets. That's only half the equation. The other part of the equation is local financial advisory firms. And I think it's a very nuanced equation, trying to line up a global private market opportunity with local private wealth. And if done incorrectly, it will be the proverbial square peg in a round hole. So we've deliberately sat back and thought about what we've learned over the last 10 years and penned a white paper on some of the things to be aware of. I think the other key factor, which is really moving very rapidly, is just this proliferation of new product that's hitting our shores. And that's good and bad. It's good in so much that it means that as an asset allocator, you've got a lot more choice around how you allocate across the four components of private equity, private debt, infrastructure, and real estate. But I think where it's very different to the traditional asset classes is that you don't have a homogenous set of products out there to assess, unlike, say, Australian shares, where you've got a very large and liquid universe with very similar terms across the managers. What we talk about in our white paper is really 10 key factors to be aware of. To pick on a few, I think the first one is fees. And unlike with say an Australian share fund, it's quite simple to understand. You'll have a management fee that's levied against NAV, and if it's in the smaller end of the equation, where there's much more scope for alpha, then there might be a performance fee. So it's not terribly difficult to compare and contrast funds. If you look at say private equity and private credit in the context of this wave of new products coming through, you've got a variety of different ways that management fees are being levied. We've seen fees on net asset value. We've seen fees on gross asset value. We've seen fees on committed capital. We've seen fees on invested capital. We've seen fees on adjusted net AV, net asset value. And it means that you really need to make sure you're looking at an apples with apples equation. And we need to ensure that there's not any change in behaviours as a result of the way that the management fees are being levied. Namely, if the fees are on gross asset value, then obviously there's an incentive to put debt into the portfolio, given that that the debt is having fees levied against it as well. The other part of that's the performance fees, and I think the way that the private equity industry has grown up is that the typical starting point is that we'll go out and we'll buy a company, and you know the limited partner and the general partner will club together to buy a company, and we'll share the profits with 80% going to the limited partner or the investor and 20% going to the general partner who's originated and run the deal and the value creation. That is, it makes a lot of sense when you're going into a private operating company and really driving operational improvement, growing the business to generate profits. If, however, you're doing private lending where you're effectively acting as a de facto bank, we sort of start to question whether or not a performance fee is relevant when there's no capital gain up for grabs. So we've been quite cynical around how capital gains get applied to direct lending strategies, because ultimately the role of the direct lender is to get rich off the coupon and avoid default. And that doesn't lend itself to a performance fee. So, but there are some managers that charge a performance fee and have done so successfully. So it's really just about understanding the nuances. I think some of the other factors relate to liquidity. I think that's probably the number one concern for advisors as they start to look at private markets. I think the general conception is that it makes a lot of sense that, you know, in terms of better returns, lower risk, but there's always a fear that they'll get locked up. And it's always that 5 or 10% of the portfolio that can dominate conversations if there's a bad experience around liquidity. So again, what's really helping is that there's so much content coming to Australia that there's a world where you can create a multi-manager strategy and have underlying liquidity across the managers that you're using to ensure that you've got multiple shots on goal to extract liquidity. Having said that, the way that the managers provide liquidity is, again, very different across the constituents. You've got some that have soft locks, some that have hard locks, some that have a 5% of NAV per quarter, others that have a best endeavors. And you really need to be very clear on how you get your money out. What is your pathway to liquidity in the event that you really need to liquidate the assets? The other element, of course, is what's the investor base that underpins the liquidity promise? Is it one or two institutional investors that may decide to change tack and all of a sudden the fund locks up? Or is it a broad base of advised clients that are all on the long-term journey? So really understanding exactly who you're investing alongside and their behaviors is very important. I think another one, and probably the final one to pick on, is valuations. I think when you're buying into an open-ended fund, you're inheriting positions that may have been there for several years, and they may have been bought at a very different time in the capital market cycle where entry multiples were higher, the amount of leverage that was being taken down to acquire the company was higher. So you really need to be clear on how the assets are being valued. And I think with this, the other complicating factor is the valuations aren't being set by a transaction. The valuations are being set by the marks that are being provided by the private equity manager. And that private equity manager, to be fair, is getting typically an annual third-party mark on that company. But there's going to be three other marks throughout the year that are really at the discretion of the manager. So really understanding the valuation approach is really key. And why that's important, particularly, for example, with, say, private credit, some valuation methodologies literally just price the value of the loans based on cost plus accrued interest. Mm-hmm. So that's a very, very slow and linear pathway to performance. Others have a more sophisticated approach where they have a mark to market type approach and they're taking a view on whether or not, looking at the portfolio of loans, there could be some impairments. And as a result, they'll mark down the price of that. Now, going into the former is great, provided you know that the portfolio is not pregnant with a couple of defaults where they will have a meaningful impact on the performance of the fund, because that news has not yet been built into the NAV that the price is, that the fund's being priced upon on a monthly or quarterly basis. Whereas the latter, you'll have more volatility, but at least you know when you're going in that the evaluations are fully baked at that time. So we really encourage advisors to reach out and have a chat to us about the trips and traps, because you're going to have more and more people knocking on your door, making the case for private markets, and we're one of those people. But I guess we're looking at it with a very cautious lens, knowing that advisory firms have got a lot to do in managing multiple clients across multiple segments and platforms and research ratings and so forth. So we want to make sure that's a round peg in a round hole.
Excellent, excellent pointers there, Stuart. Let's just clarify in terms of minimum investment amounts. What are you seeing in terms of that? And what can we expect in terms of returns?
Sure. Well, I think the Americans coined the term democratization of private markets. We borrowed that over the years ourselves. And that started with saying, well, initially you needed $10 million and you need to lock up money for 10 years to access private markets. And that, as you can imagine, precluded a lot of people. And over time, again, born in the US, you've seen that lower to what's known as a qualified purchase definition, and that is 5 million of assets outside the family home. And of late, in the US, that's being lowered to an accredited investor level. making it more and more accessible. And then with the onset of platforms and aggregation points, then the platform as the custodian sort of speaks for the investor and turns up as one single line. So, you know, it, applying that to Australia, it means that if you invest through one of the leading platforms like Netwealth or Hub24, then there isn't a minimum. So it's really become accessible. And again, I guess you just need to be careful with that much accessibility and that much availability across clients, notwithstanding that many of these offerings are still wholesale. Just need to be careful that you're across everything before you proceed, given that there's a lot of sharp elbowed, very good marketers in private equity firms that are very, very competent at selling the story. So I think the minimums have really been lowered significantly in terms of the dollar amount. I think the qualification to participate is an interesting one. We see now that that the government's talking about increasing the wholesale test. Mm-hmm. That will obviously that will go in reverse relative to what's happening globally in terms of access to private markets. I think from our perspective, we've created a solution that's a retail offering so that retail investors don't get left behind in this transition. But I think, yeah, you'll probably see a bit more of that as well. I think obviously the challenge there is just making sure that the advisors that are serving the retail investors are empowered with all of the education and information so that they know how the liquidity works in the portfolio. And ironically, retail investors with advisors are stickier money than what we've seen in some of the very large institutional offerings like what Blackstone have offered, where you, and that's not a knock on Blackstone, but we saw that with their BREIT product where it had to lock up. That's their flagship open-ended real estate program. And when you look through the why, it was really hot money, direct investors sort of moving in and out of other parts of the world that sort of didn't really buy into the long-term thesis. So we think in Australia, like really looking around the room and knowing who else is in the portfolio with you makes a big difference.
Oh, and just quickly in terms of returns?
In returns, good point. So it really does. I mean, this is sort of finance 101, risk versus return. It really depends on which part of the market you're talking about. Typically, you have at the riskier end of the private market spectrum, you have venture capital. These are loss-making businesses that may be a concept or an idea that haven't yet hit profitability. You then move into growth companies where they may be generating a profit, but really need an injection of capital to scale. Then you go into buyout situations where the companies are fully fled quality companies and a private equity sponsor is coming in to, you know, accelerate that through a change of operations, all the way through to special situations where you've got a turnaround story where the company's sort of it's moved through its full potential and it's now starting to deteriorate. I think thinking about private equity with that and that continuum of the stages of financing, you would expect that the venture capital, you'd be getting 20% plus type IRRs. For the growth companies, again, you're sort of looking at 15% plus, and that's likewise for special situations and turnarounds. So I think the risk is really a determinant of the return, like all the other asset classes. If we then turn to private credit, which obviously is proliferating like crazy globally, it's also a very broad church. And again, I don't want to get too technical, but I think in if you just look at, say, lending money to a company versus lending money against a piece of real estate, you're looking at, with base rates now at fours and fives, depending on where you are in the world, you're looking at direct lending at tens and 11s. And for real asset construction finance, you're looking at sort of 13 plus. And for refis on real assets, that's a really challenging part of the market, given that the office as a asset class is really in a bit of a funk in terms of the hangover from COVID and a structural oversupply of stock relative to the demand. So there are certain parts of private debt that are potentially uninvestable at the moment, like they are in real estate, just because you've got the hangover from COVID and the working from home issues still to fully burn off. What we sort of generally say is you take all those numbers and you roll it up into a diversified multi-asset, multi-manager style portfolio, and you should be expecting at least 10 to 13% net on the assumption that there's monthly liquidity. And importantly, that is a premium to the 7 to 9% that you might be getting out of your daily liquid SMA or your model portfolio, and it needs to be, because otherwise why would you be taking on the illiquidity risk? But equally, if you're only taking monthly illiquidity risk, then you shouldn't expect to be getting the 15% plus type returns, because there's only so many constraints you can put on an investment manager to deliver returns. So if you are willing to step out to, say, a five-year lockup, then that's when you should be expecting the 15% plus return. So I think that the risk level and the level of liquidity are the two key determinants. Yeah, and again, we welcome advice to sort of work through the matrix and figure out what's relevant to their practice.
Stuart, that has been a fascinating conversation. Thank you so much. And that was very well explained, especially for those looking or eyeing into this asset class. And thank you everyone for joining Financial Standards podcast today. And thank you again, Stuart.
Thanks, Karen. Well done.
Thanks for listening to this Financial Standard podcast. For more information, visit financialstandard.com.au. Please keep in mind that the information discussed in this podcast is general in nature and does not consider personal circumstances. Reliance should not be placed on any content without further independent financial research and advice.